There is a sense of joy here. However, it is not complete as we are in the midst of a war and have been forced to leave our homes. Our lives are simply too difficult. Prices are really high. I have a newborn baby and thinking about how to provide her with milk, diapers, clothes, nourishment. Everything is outrageously expensive here. I even suffered from hunger during pregnancy and childbirth, but I'm very grateful to God for having this girl after my only son was killed.
We've had a great time celebrating our birthdays. I'm eager to return to my home in Gaza City. We wish to return to our hometowns and schools. This war will eventually come to an end, God willing.
Newborn Aysen and the 12 children, Maya and Yasin, don't know if they will live for the next days. But the war in Gaza, which killed more than 43,000 Palestinians, mostly children and women, and wounded over 105,000 others, has never changed the resilience and steadfastness of the Palestinian people. And the happiness we've just lived today with those people is a reflection of eternal hope they have been always clinging on to. Abu Bakr Abid, Deir al-Balah, Gaza.
As temperatures drop in Gaza, displaced Palestinians living in makeshift tents with little food or warm clothes are bracing for the approaching winter, the second since the war began. Hundreds of thousands of families are trapped under uninterrupted Israeli strikes hitting every corner of the coastal strip.
We didn't find any other place but this one after we were displaced from northern Gaza and then from Rafah. We call on those who are still conscientious to look at us and stand with us. Unfortunately, the entire world has let us down. Honestly, living here on the beach this winter is more horrible than the war itself.
The heavy rain has also flooded the tents of the displaced in different parts of the Gaza Strip. While some Palestinians managed to retrieve their children from the sea, their lives were in ruins when the high tidal waves swept over their flimsy makeshift tents.
Suddenly, we lost everything, our tents, belongings, and tarps. Our tent was sheltering 15 people, including my daughters and their children. Look, our children barely survived the heavy rains and strong waves. They only have the pieces of clothing they're wearing. We don't know what to do or where to go. No one cares about us.
Nearly 14 months of Israeli genocide in Gaza has reduced the coastal strip to ruins and rubble. Palestinians are trapped under brutal bombardments, facing unbearable starvation, and now perishing weather conditions.
With the harsh winter looming to make the humanitarian crisis in Gaza even worse, only an end to the war could offer the displaced Palestinians real hope. Israel's deadly assault, however, continues with no sign of ending, while the whole world remains silent on the ongoing genocide in Gaza. The middle area of Gaza Strip.
Places of worship have been highly sensitive in the Indian subcontinent since the 1947 partition. In India, disputes over them are frequently exploited for political gain, playing on voter sentiments. On Sunday, a survey of the centuries-old Grand Mosque in Uttar Pradesh Sambal district sparked deadly clashes, claiming 5 lives. Hindu groups claimed the mosque was built on a destroyed temple during Mughal rule, while Muslim groups are fighting related legal cases in various courts. In recent years, Hindu groups in many states have filed numerous lawsuits alleging that mosques were built on erased Hindu temples during the Mughal era.
Sunday's incident has reignited fears of violence over a sensitive religious dispute in the world's most populous nation, which is marred by the history of communal carnage after the partition of India in 1947, at the end of British rule.
Hindu activists and groups, many affiliated, with Prime Minister Modi's ruling party, claims several mosques were built on the sites of centuries-old Hindu temples raised by the Mughal Empire. Observers note these groups have grown bolder since the recent inauguration of a controversial Hindu temple built on the site of a Babri mosque in Ayodhya, destroyed by a Hindu mob on December 6, 1992. Muslim groups denounced this as a violation of the Places of Worship Act 1991, despite lower courts ordering such surveys, and are calling for Supreme Court intervention.
This drive has been ongoing since the demolition of the Babri Mosque. It's been a deliberate political agenda since 1990. Unfortunately, even the court judgment failed to serve justice, despite the lack of evidence proving the Babri Mosque was built after razing a temple. This is all a political conspiracy by communal forces.
Prominent Muslim scholars condemned the recent violence, calling it a clear example of lawlessness, injustice and cruelty. Activists echoed this sentiment, stating that the ruling party aims to reduce Muslims to second-class citizens with limited civil liberties, unable to even protest for their constitutionally guaranteed fundamental rights.
We have to understand that these are essential elements of the ideology of Bharatiya Janata Party, and all these acts are aimed at marginalizing Muslims and criminalizing all aspects of their life and to restrain their living. That is the ideology of Bharatiya Janata Party. We have to understand it, and therefore we call it fascism.
Rights activists and observers say that since the ruling party came to power in 2014, Muslims have faced systematic repression, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the new citizenship law, and now the push for a uniform civil code and the seizure of Muslim charitable properties waqf. Activists say the aim is to disempower Muslims as a part of a larger political agenda to create a unified Hindu First India. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
On Tuesday, foreign ministers from seven of the world's major economies gathered for a second day of talks in the historic town of Fuji, southeast of Rome. During the two-day summit, the ministers of Italy, US, Canada, UK, France, Germany and Japan discussed the situation in West Asia, Ukraine and in the Indo-Pacific as pressure to advance diplomatic efforts to resolve crisis in these regions is mounting. A group of pro-Palestine protesters staged a static demonstration in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians in the vicinity of the venue of the summit meeting. The G7 countries have provided political support for the Israeli regime and have significantly contributed to increasing insecurity and instability in West Asia, particularly through the U.S. military and financial support for Tel Aviv.
This is the G7 summit of genocide. All countries involved are Israel's major accomplices. Not only the US and the EU have unconditionally provided weapons to Netanyahu, but they have not done anything to stop the genocide. They have never condemned Israel for its atrocities. Furthermore, they are trying to delegitimize the International Criminal Court after arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant were issued.
During the protest, international law experts explained that Italy must abide by the ICC's rulings, being one of the early signatories of the treaty that established the International Criminal Court.
I hope the ICC will issue arrest warrants also for all individuals from the US and the EU administrations and for whoever has violated international norms. Enough with this unbearable double standard. Enough with Israel's impunity.
The G7 summit saw the European Union's outgoing foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, say there are no excuses for Israel to refuse to accept a ceasefire with the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah.
We demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, but above all that Israel ends its carnage, its ethnic cleansing, its genocide, which some still find it hard to call it this way.
For the first time, the G7 ministers were joined by their counterparts from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, as well as the Secretary General of the Arab League, Max Civili Fiuggi.
Dozens of medical professionals and health workers gathered in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, united in outrage and grief. Their protests aimed to highlight the ongoing violence in Gaza and Lebanon, denouncing what they called Israel's deliberate attacks on hospitals, doctors, and patients.
Our protest today is not only for the health sector in Sana'a, but also in the rest of the governorates. It is a show of solidarity with the Palestinian and Lebanese people, especially the health sector that is suffering greatly amid the ongoing Israeli aggression. We here want to express our full solidarity and our condemnation of the humanitarian and health violations that are taking place.
The demonstrators didn't mince words, accusing Israel of genocide and calling on the international community to take urgent action. They urged the United Nations to pressure Tel Aviv to halt its aggression, which has left more than 54,000 people dead or missing and over 100,000 injured in Gaza alone over the past year.
We declare our full solidarity with Gaza and Lebanon against the direct and systematic violation and targeting by the Zionist entity against health cadres and infrastructure and putting them out of service. We have previously suffered from the U.S.-backed Saudi aggression, so we declare our readiness to go to Gaza and Lebanon to save civilians there.
Among the chants and placards, a sense of vindication was palpable. The group hailed the International Criminal Court's recent arrest warrants for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Minister of Military Affairs Yoav Gallant. For these demonstrators, it's a rare moment of justice in what they describe as a dark chapter of impunity.
For these health workers in Sana'a, the protest is more than a display of solidarity. They see it as a moral obligation to stand against what they describe as crimes against humanity. Their message to the international community is clear. It's time for accountability and action. Abdulatif Al-Washalib, Sana'a.
Canaan, the sixth edition of the Palestine Film Festival, opened in the Austrian capital Vienna on Monday night. The event aimed to create a platform for Palestinian filmmakers and films that address the lives and resistance of Palestinians in Palestine. Organizers told Press TV that it brings the stories and culture of Palestinians closer to the Viennese audience.
To support the Palestinian cause. And this is one of our main aims with this festival, to demonstrate that Palestinians are not only a fighting people fighting for their survival, but they are ready and they prove that they have a long tradition, they have culture, they are educated, and they have, in the meantime, there are many Palestinian film directors who got prizes.
On the first night, the film days opened with the recently completed film Where Olive Trees Weep, by Zaya and Maurizio Benazzo. It provides a magnificent and shocking insight into the everyday life, struggles and resilience of the Palestinian people under the Israeli regime's occupation.
There is a certain mobilization, and our festival is part of this kind of mobilization of information to demonstrate people are supporting the Palestinians and motivate other people to do the same.
The Palestine Film Days were opened by Palestinian Ambassador Salah Abdel Shafi and attended by several other representatives and diplomats who used the event to show solidarity with Palestine. Among those were the ambassadors of Algeria and Malaysia. Over the coming days, movies about the 1948 Nakba, life under occupation in Al-Khalil, and the resistance of Bedouin community will be screened. Due to the overwhelming success of the Palestine Film Days, the organizers are already preparing for a seventh edition of the event in the coming spring.
Most film screenings were sold out before the festival. This despite a complete media blackout. The success of the festival is therefore a stark reminder of the solidarity with Palestine in Austria. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
When the world speaks of women empowerment, the world remembers names of women who changed science, business, and politics. Today, the world will remember not just the names, but the faces of women changing humanity and defining the concept of strength itself in Gaza and in Lebanon. Earlier this month, the UN Human Rights Office declared that 70% of those killed by Israel in Gaza were women and children. The UN data estimates that over 10,000 women in Gaza have been killed, over 19,000 have been wounded, over 3,000 have become widows, and 37 mothers are killed every day. Hundreds of women have been killed in Lebanon, while many have lost their husbands and their children, and thousands have been left without homes. The UN Women Office in New York declined to give us a statement when we notified them that the report was about Gaza, but we got the chance to speak to the head of the United Nations Population Fund office in Gaza, who put into perspective the situation on the ground.
So this war, it's a year, it's over a year now, and each other day, women are exposed to very high levels of risk. This is a place right now with the highest levels of indignity for a woman. Access, like you said, to sanitary and hygiene materials is very, very difficult. Even when the humanitarian community, including the United Nations, has a lot of such materials procured, access to Gaza becomes very difficult. We've seen pregnant women in communities like Jabalia in North Gaza Governorate, where they are trapped, not able to quickly access, you know, routine antenatal care. You know, that is violence. Violence is not just about being bitten, but it's also about a lack of access to life-saving interventions for a woman when they need it. So I agree with you that this situation equally is a violation of the rights of these women to access quality health care, to access the right information on how to keep their babies safe.
Women in Palestine detained illegally by the Israeli occupation and imprisoned by them are subject to assault, strip searches, forced removal of hijabs and clothes, torture, threats, and sexual abuse, many of which go unreported. These women are protected under prisoner of war status under the Geneva Conventions and international humanitarian law. Yet justice seems to overlook them. Western media has been portraying the women of Lebanon and Gaza as helpless and vulnerable, rather than exposing the international law violations by Israel towards these women and girls that are enforcing this violence against them. Selective humanity has become so normalized that it's no surprise that many of those who preach of defending women ignore the cries of women whose dignities are violated by Israel. It is pointless to be a woman's rights advocate if you do not stand up against the imprisonment, the torture, and the killing of women in Gaza and in Lebanon. Women standing in the face of the occupation of their land and the violation of their honor cannot and will not be marginalized. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a large number of women from across the country. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on December 27, 2023. Now let's look at the topic of women. Well, praise God, we are all knowledgeable, educated, and well aware of the various issues that are raised in Islam regarding the topic of women. There is no need for me to say much on this matter. Nonetheless, I will share a few words with you. Regarding the issue of women, the questions of feminine identity and woman's identity, woman's value, rights, duties, freedoms, and limitations are each crucial and pivotal matters. Today, if we take an overall look at the world, we will see there are two distinct orientations or approaches in all of these areas. The first one is the prevalent Western approach, which has gained popularity in non-Western countries as well, in all the areas that I mentioned. The second approach is the Islamic approach, and these two approaches are in opposition to each other. Each approach has its own perspective and opinions regarding the issues and questions at hand. It is possible to engage in discussions and find answers in all of these areas. However, there is one issue here which I believe deserves our attention, and that is that the West's system of culture and civilization is not willing to discuss these matters. It escapes from entering these discussions and research on women's issues.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Western culture and the Western system, the West's system of civilization and culture, does not come forward to discuss many questions in these areas. Instead, it promotes its viewpoint and approach through controversial means, rowdyism, using the arts, movies, coercion, cyberspace, and such things. Not having logical reasoning, it promotes its own opinions and approaches using the various tools at its disposal. It is not willing to take part in discussions, nor is it prepared to answer questions. The reason for this is that the West has no logical reasoning. There is no logic behind the worsening, ever-increasing, ridiculous approach to women's issues prevalent in the West today, as well as in many countries that follow the West. Therefore, it refuses to discuss this matter and is unwilling to provide any reasoning for its actions. Why is it that a disregard for maintaining the dignity and femininity of women in Western societies is increasing on a daily basis? Why is it that women are disrespected more and more every day? Why is it that a scantily clad woman can attend the official gatherings that are held in Europe and the US, even their official meetings, but a man must be fully clothed? He must even wear a tie or a bow tie in order to participate. Why? Why can a woman show up like that? But if a man wears shorts in formal gatherings, for example, this is considered to be a bad etiquette.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all. Gave me hope, oh Allah.
option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The Zionist war machine has now entered into its day of cessation of hostilities with Lebanon, as displaced Lebanese rejoice in the victory of resistance against aggression. They continue to return to their cities, villages, and towns, which were, as Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabi Berri, stated yesterday, cleansed by the blood of martyrs. The Israeli leadership has now spent billions on failed campaigns in Palestine, Lebanon, and to some extent in Syria, to achieve any of their stated goals. And just like their handlers in Washington, London, Paris, and Berlin over the past 25 years have failed to achieve victory in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. We'll discuss Israel's continuity of defeat along with the rest of the axis of Western losers in this installment of your Spotlight. And our guests. Joining us is Daniel Yegich, author and researcher from Beirut. And Mr. Adwan Rizk, political analyst, also joining us from the Lebanese capital.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you to the program here, Daniel Yegich, joining us from Beirut. We're going to start with you. How do you assess, Daniel, the actions of the Israeli entity in Lebanon over this past year and its level of success leading up to a ceasefire?
So the actions of the Israeli regime can be described once again as criminal and genocidal, with a complete military failure. The Israeli regime in the past more than 1 year, and in particular in the last 2 months or so, has been intensifying its military aggression against Lebanon, against the Lebanese population, and against Lebanon's civilian infrastructure. It has targeted civilian buildings. It has massacred people, including children, in schools and shelters. It has destroyed mosques and churches, and we see once again the same history of the Israeli occupation in Lebanon, because of course we can go back to 1948 when the first Israeli attacks happened on Lebanon, just as the Zionist state was proclaimed. But even after causing so much damage to the civilians and displacing approximately a quarter of Lebanon's population in this rather densely populated country, the Israeli regime, of course, has not achieved any goals. It was not able to disarm or to destroy the resistance. On the contrary, it has once again basically showed the necessity of the resistance to protect Lebanon from these aggressions. And so we can characterize it very much as a military failure, because at the end, other than killing people, the Israeli regime has not been able to achieve any of the goals that the Netanyahu regime had stated at the beginning of this aggression.
Thank you. Also, like to welcome now Mr. Radwan Risk, also joining us from Lebanese capital. Mr. Risk, Hezbollah, with just a fraction, sir, of Israel's military capabilities, was in this fight all along, right up to the ceasefire wasn't announced. In fact, Secretary General Naeem Qassem said, if need be, resistance is ready for a long fight if this cessation of hostilities was not to take a shape. From your perspective, what did the Israeli entity achieve, either militarily or politically, with trying to achieve any of its objectives in Lebanon?
Well, so far as the time to sign the ceasefire reached by all sides proves that the Israelis have failed to achieve any of their goals on all levels, because military they couldn't enter or gain more than 2 or 3 kilometers on the ground, and they were defeated. They failed to gain or to invade the town of Khiyam or Bint Jbeil or even the Bayada or Tair Harfa. All those villages along the borders were still fighting at the time of the ceasefire signed. So politically, I believe that all these clashes among the politicians in Israel, and we have seen, we have heard, voices rising from all levels, from the settlers or some of the mayors of some settlements, blaming Netanyahu for this disasters happened to Israel, and they call it's the biggest or the worst disaster to happen in Israel since 1948. So Netanyahu was humiliated in a way, was forced to sign or to go to call for a ceasefire, because he was putting very high hopes and goals. He wanted to enter Lebanon, and he promised the by force to retain to return the settlers to their settlements in the northern of occupied Palestine. And at some point was warning the Lebanese people along the Owali River. Owali River, for your just for audience to know, it's on along the Saida city, which is about 60 kilometers from the 60 to 70 kilometers from the borders. So he was hoping to repeat the same story that happened in 1982 invasion, when he reached Beirut in 72 hours. This did not happen this time, and the repeat of the image of 2006 war, he gained nothing at all, but a defeat. The resistance promised to go along for a very long war, and it was ready as it was promised by Sheikh Naeem Qassem, the leader of Hezbollah. And Netanyahu now, he is in a very bad situation. And the story is now it's totally different being told inside and out in Israel. So I think that's the shape of the Netanyahu now is in a very, very, very bad situation. And, Israel was humiliated from this ceasefire again. And we are seeing another defeat in Israel also.
I'm glad you mentioned and alluded to that, Mr. Risk. Daniel, I'd like you to elaborate, if you could, on your thoughts on the internal struggles, the divides, the growing divides and fractures we're not just seeing in Israeli Zionist politics, but also in Israeli society from October 7th of last year until the end of August this year. There were 1,240 protests on the streets of Israeli-occupied Palestine by the Israelis against mostly their own cabinet, their own leadership. This is an average, Daniel, of 113 protests per month against Netanyahu and his cabinet by the Israeli people. Your thoughts on that?
Yes, so I think it shows very much how fragmented the settler society is. And in the end, we need to remember that the Israeli regime is an artificial construct. It is an ongoing colonial project, and the settlers live there in the first, third, or second generation. These are people who come from different backgrounds. And one of the things that ties the settler community together is, of course, their supremacist situation within the colony and their hatred against the indigenous people. But beyond that, of course, even before October 7, the Israeli society was very significantly divided on political questions and ideological questions in particular. And the way in which the Netanyahu regime has dealt with the settlers has been a source of controversy. We, of course, need to keep in mind that most of these protests were within and among the settlers. There has been no real opposition within the entity against the genocides against Gaza and Lebanon. So much of it also comes from within the self-interest of the settler community. But it again, once again, just shows how fragile the Israeli regime is. And we need to remember that Netanyahu in particular, who is facing corruption charges within the entity, has an interest in prolonging this war, because this war also serves as a distraction from these internal insecurities. But at the end of the day, the Israeli entity is weaker than it has ever been, not only when it comes to its military position, its perspective towards Lebanon, once again being defeated by the Lebanese resistance, but also within the entity. So what we are witnessing here is an existential crisis on many different levels.
Interesting. And Mr. Radwan Risk, the irony also here is that the more disunity and discord we see today growing in Israeli society, just that much more we're seeing regional resistance groups more united and more unprecedented cooperation and collaboration than we have ever seen, I'm sure, to Washington and Tel Aviv's disdain.
Well, the Western world, led by the Americans, must understand that the era or the time of occupation and suppressing people all over the world is just ended, because the resistance camp led by the Islamic Republic of Iran is refusing to just to kneel down in front of the of those occupiers or people wants to put the other people or other countries under their mandate. So now they are dealing fiercely, fighting the resistance groups all over the area, especially in the Middle East, where they don't have any welcoming to be controlled by the Americans or their operators, the Israelis, because that's Israel now has lost its job by providing all the interest and business of the Europeans or the Americans. And now I think they are in a very deep trouble, because the Americans, as Biden said, doesn't want to send troops on the ground to the Middle East. Why did he say that? Because he believes and he understands now that the Israelis have failed to do the job for the Americans or for the Europeans. So they are in a very bad situation. either they want to come themselves to send troops, as they said, as they did in 1982, and they were sent and they were kicked out by force, and now we might face the same situation. We don't know yet because the ceasefire is very fragile and shaky a lot. Because as I was entering the studio, I've heard that an air raid took place in the south by jet fighter firing two rockets at the village of Tair Harfa, and also the two journalists in Khiam village were shot. Injured by the Israeli army. So now the responsibility is in front of the whole world. If they cannot keep their promises by signing this kind of ceasefire, would they allow the Israelis to keep on going on its war on the civilians and the Lebanese soil? So now the Lebanese army and the UNIFIL and the whole countries who joined this committee to protect or to sign or join the ceasefire agreement, now they are in a very now they are in front of a very hard exam. So if they cannot do their job, that will prove again and again that nothing can protect the country but the resistance and the resistance fighters, who proves once again for the fourth time since 1993 till now that Lebanon cannot be protected, or people in any other country cannot be protected only by force of the resistance or strong armies, let's say national army. So in our country, unfortunately, our army does not have any equipment or well prepared to go against the Israelis, because of due to our situation in the country, and also that the resistance took place as the people who descend from those villages along the borders, and they proved once again that they are able to protect the country or to defeat the Israelis, and also supporting and fighting for the Palestinian cause, because we must know that we consider in our beliefs that the Israelis are the enemies that we must fight in order if we want to save our sovereignty and independence.
Thank you, Mr. Risk. And Daniel, Mr. Risk made an interesting point. He said the day of the colonizer has come and gone. It is over. And earlier in my lead, as I kicked off the program, I referred to the collective West as the axis of losers, because they've been suffering some serious losses in the region of West Asia, in Afghanistan over the last 25 years, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. My question to you, the days, it seems, of the mighty colonizer coming in through killing and conquering and controlling countries has literally come to an end. What has changed, Daniel?
So I think you're absolutely right. It is coming to an end because what we see unfolding today, again, with the Israeli actions in the genocide in Gaza, occupation of Lebanon, the continuous attacks on Syria, it's a continuity of the same structure. There is, of course, the Western colonial history in this region, the imperialism that has been led increasingly by the United States in the past decades, and, of course, the entire existence of the Israeli entity as an outpost of the collective West in the East or in Western Asia. But their hegemony and, in fact, the mere existence of the Israeli regime requires perpetual warfare. This is an artificial construct that can only survive as long as it keeps its apartheid regime alive, as long as it continues to kill and suppress and oppress everything and everyone around them and destroy anything that stands in the way of the settler colonial conquest. But this, of course, has also produced generations of resistance, of people who continue to resist by staying on their land, by fighting back, by defending themselves. And in the end, the Western hegemony in the world has been weakened. We are at a point where what I would describe as global apartheid, where there's a small minority of the collective West, that is the United States and its proxies, that dominates the vast majority of the world's population. But we've seen the resistance being stronger, the resistance being interconnected, be that from Lebanon to Iran and Iran's support for resistance groups in the region from Iraq to Yemen and elsewhere, that of course continue their alliance and their resistance against these genocidal dynamics. And that, of course, and I think this is also a core to answer a crucial part to answer the question, that also share the ideology, whereas the Western power relations are very much based on internal dominance, hierarchies, and transactional relationships that the U.S. has with its proxies. So I think taking these factors into consideration, this is a fight that the West cannot win. And I think if we look at, in particular, the circumstances and the legal circumstances that the Israeli regime is in right now, in addition to its military weakening and the ongoing genocide, we could also very well say that the collective West is, through the Israeli regime, very much fighting for its survival, or the survival of its brutal hegemony.
Thank you, Daniel. And Mr. Risk, from your perspective, the stark differences we have seen when it comes between Hezbollah's retaliatory attacks and the way Israel targeted Lebanon. My question to you, the differences when it comes to Hezbollah, the majority of its retaliatory operations were against Israeli military targets. When it came to Israel, we saw the opposite. Most of its attacks were against civilian infrastructure. Why do you see such a huge difference when it comes to war policy, war conduct, and war strategy between the two?
Well, I believe that the Israelis have targeted all civilians, places, villages, schools, everywhere, because I believe and I know that they have a problem, because what they know about the infrastructure of the resistance is very little, that despite all their intelligence efforts that they made over past 18 years, they have succeeded somehow, very little, by the pagers explosions and the talkie-walkie, and they thought that by assassinating the martyr Hassan Nasrallah, it was the end of the war. They were surprised, very much so. For them, it was very difficult to find the infrastructure or the bases of the Hezbollah. It was very well hidden, very well protected from any information. So all those air raids and over the villages or in Bekaa Valley did not affect the power of Hezbollah at all. On the other side, let's say that the moral and the values of Hezbollah fighters does not allow them to hit any civilian's target, because it's a war, an army and against an army, a resistance against an army. So they were hammering the bases of the Israeli army very well, destroying many of them, putting some of them out of orders for at least during this war, and shooting down many of their drones, intelligent drones like Hermes 14, 450 and 900. So that was a very big success. When it comes to the ground battle, they could have the ability or would have the chance to hit the Israeli civilians, but they did not. Instead of that, they kept on concentrating on destroying the tanks of the Israeli army, which is, by the way, was very afraid to send many tanks inside Lebanon. That's why we have seen that the tanks were destroyed only about 60 tanks in 60 days. So, but in 2006. In one day, the Israelis lost in Wadi al-Hujair 75 tanks in one day, and that forced them to call and urge for beg for a ceasefire. And now it's the same story repeated again, that they were urging at the end of this war for a ceasefire. That's why they accepted what's so-called a humiliated ceasefire for the Israeli army. And okay. I believe it is so. It is very humiliating for the Israeli army not being able to invade a small country and to take over a few villages against fighters, which is, you know, my information and what we know, they're not more than hundreds of them, defeated this brutal army with all its sophisticated weapons used by the green light of the Americans and Germany also, and many other countries or its you know, their allies. Lebanon will not be defeated, and victory will be always on its side because has a resistance that will never lay down the arm and will never kneel before the enemies for them.
We don't have much time left. I really want to get this last question out to Daniel. Why do you think the Israeli regime jumped at this quick opportunity to ink the ceasefire deal in Lebanon, and why it's dragged its feet when it comes to Gaza, and what are the implications and the ramifications now for a possible Gaza, from your perspective, ceasefire moving forward?
So I think it was eventually had to agree to the ceasefire because it was defeated in Lebanon, and it's facing a very different military challenge in Lebanon than it is in Gaza. In Gaza, the Israeli regime, but even here in the ground battle, hasn't been as effective as it would have liked to. We need to remember, even in Gaza, the Israeli regime continues to, through aerial bombardments, massacre people, to starve them, to kill them in all ways, unspeakable ways possible, and to kill children. And so this is very much the military strategy of the Israeli regime. It has not been able to face an actual military army, that is Hezbollah, on the battlefield in the country of Lebanon, and it was very much weakened to an extent where it had to agree to the ceasefire, which is why this can be identified as a victory for the resistance and liberation movement of Hezbollah. In Gaza, the situation is different due to the military, but also the geographic circumstances. Gaza is a small territory under siege, and the Israeli regime apparently does not feel the need or the pressure that it would have to agree to a ceasefire, because there it also still enjoys the maximum support of its backers, including the United States and the outgoing Biden-Harris regime is responsible for this genocide and continues to advocate for it.
We're out of time. I want to thank you both. Pleasure to have you both on, and thank you for both your respective contributions to the program here. Mr. Daniel Yegish, author and researcher there, joining us from Beirut, and also Radwan Risk, political